Everyone, it's March 2017, and thanks for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. You're listening to episode 32 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts. Jay is vice president of Life Training Institute. He speaks at universities, high schools, and churches across the United States, and he participates in numerous radio and television interviews about the value of human life. In the current issue, volume 40, number 1 of the Christian Research Journal, Jay has written a feature article called On Chimeras and What It Means to Be Human. In his article, Jay explores how Christians should think ethically about chimera research, which is the genetic mixing of humans and non-human animals. Jay, it's good to have you on.
It's great to be back.
Well, I remember first hearing about this. I was driving along the road listening to NPR, and they started talking about the potential for the National Institutes of Health to start this new kind of research. So can you please, for our listeners, give a simple explanation of what exactly is human and animal chimera research?
Yeah, human animal chimera research is where you attempt to mix on a genetic level the two different animals in a way that it profoundly impacts the animal. And what we do is we take what are called pluripotent cells, either pre-gastrulation, which is early, very early in the beginning of an embryo's life, or after specialization begins, where we focus it on particular systems, and we inject those pluripotent cells in there. And what it does is it mixes so that you have, as the animal cells replicates, the human cells are replicating right alongside the animal's cells. And so what you end up with, like, for example, pigs, which we would use to do this, because pigs have organs that are very compatible to humans for transplant purposes, we would want to make them more compatible. And in an effort to do that, we would implant these pluripotent cells early in the development, and then they would replicate through the pig. And so you would have a pig heart that was much more human than normal pig heart would be, obviously, that would have no human cells in it. So all of the things that would make a pig's organs usable have become augmented now, and you would have a much lower chance in that particular case of the body rejecting something because you have human qualities within it.
So you use the word pluripotent. Can you kind of break down that technical term a little bit more for us? So what is meant when cells are described as pluripotent?
Yeah, pluripotent cells are cells that are early in the embryo's development. There are two kinds of early cells. There's what's called a totipotent cell and a pluripotent cell. Totipotent cells only exist in the first few cell divisions. Totipotent cells can literally become anything within the developmental process of a human being or any animal. So that means the early cells can become not just the body, but also the placenta or things like that. A pluripotent cell is part of the inner cell mass at the right before what's called the gastrulation phase and the primitive streak forming, and those cells can become any part of the body. So they're capable of being put into a system, and they can become anything. And that's what makes embryonic stem cell research so attractive, and then stem cell research in and of itself when we use what we call induced pluripotent cells, where we take a mature cell that is already specialized, and they call the process they call teasing it back and making it pluripotent again. Because you can take this pluripotent cell, you can put it into a system, and it's capable of becoming any cell within the body. It exists pre-specialization. It's that point when you're an embryo, when all humans or all animals are embryos, where the cells that we have are about to specialize but have not yet specialized, so they can become anything. And if you put them in a system, they will become anything.
Okay, you just introduced a bunch of other more technical terms for us, so I do want you to break down some of this. You mentioned like pre-gastrulation, primitive streak. So what's the difference between pre-gastrulation introduction of pluripotent human cells and post-gastrulation and also after the formation of, you mentioned the primitive streak. Can you kind of break that down for us?
Yeah, and that's the great thing about this subject matter. It's fascinating, but I think one of the things that makes it difficult for people who don't play with these terms or aren't familiar with them is that they can not do the ethical reflection necessary because they're kind of scared off by the term. So what we're talking about with pre-gastrulation and post-gastrulation is the formation of the primitive streak is what divides those two things up. The primitive streak is the beginning of the nervous system. So what happens in an early embryo's life, as I said, when we first come into existence, we are made up of these pluripotent cells. Totipotents then turn to pluripotent cells. We can become anything. But at some point, they have to start becoming something. And so the very first sign that that's happening is a primitive streak, the beginning of the nervous system. And it divides the cell. And from that point on, everything starts to be sent to different parts of the body. It's not even just that the cells start to specialize, it's they start to locate themselves in very specific areas. Once the primitive streak forms, there is an area where the brain will develop, there is an area that is towards the legs. All of that is decided at that moment. Actually, they believe now, research shows that it's being decided earlier than that. But this is when the cells start to become specialized. So if I put pluripotent cells into it pre-gastrulation, then that means that once it starts to specialize, they'll go everywhere. So let's say we put it into a pig embryo. We're not restraining where those cells are going. So there's going to be a little humanity all throughout this, or a lot of humanity, depending on how many cells we try to put into that early embryo. We have the capacity of making a pig that has more human than pig in it. And that's where we get into the concept of chimera. But if we do it post-gastrulation, then we put things into very specialized area. There's a research program that's been going on at Stanford by a guy by the name of Dr. Weissman, where they've been introducing human brain cells into mice, stem cells that go into the mouse brain system so that they can produce a brain that would be better for research on how human brains work within a mouse, so that we don't have the troubling aspect of researching that kind of stuff on human beings.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit more about these Stanford mice. In your article, do you talk about how the NIH requires, you know, these subjects to have baseline measurements like these mice? So how, you know, is there time, what is, actually, explain that. What does that mean exactly?
A baseline is done all the time medically. It's where you look for where something operates normally. So, for example, with the Stanford mice, Agneta Sutton, in her book about Christian concern of ethics in this area of biotechnology and bioethics, she talks about in the Stanford experiment, what they've done with their baseline is they've measured and said, okay, if we have mice that start acting peculiar, that start to behave in a way that would be seen as not mouse-like, indicating some frustration, some suffering, something that shows that they've done a radical change at this point, and it's troubling as far as the behavior that they're seeing in the mice, that they have a protocol to destroy that entire mouse line, which is troubling for reasons that are beyond just the idea of destroying life, but the idea that they're trying to create something that has a lot of humanity in it for the purposes of producing research that has been more beneficial to humanity than just looking at mice. But so now they're looking to see if these mice start to show attitudes, behavior, something that indicates that something has gone wrong, and if that's the case, they destroy it. Now, going wrong can go either way, because the ISSCR, which is the International Society for Stem Cell Research, has guidelines, and in those guidelines, they rigorously call for all baseline testing because they acknowledge they haven't the slightest idea the ultimate long-term effects on these types of experiments. There can be what we would call germline effects, where it pollutes or changes the germline radically, which will have long-term impact on the species going forward, or these could be effects that are just localized in particular areas. So what they want is a baseline understanding to watch out for how these animals change, because they acknowledge we're doing things that we don't fully understand the impact for, even on the short-term or long-term.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts, who has written a feature article called On Chimeras and What It Means to Be Human for the Volume 40, Number 1 issue of the Christian Research Journal. Jay's article is in a very special issue of the journal, which is only available as a thank you gift for your donation to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. So to donate and receive this issue, Volume 40, Number 1, please go to quip.org. We are talking to Jay about chimeras, and the research on those, which is the genetic mixing of human and non-human animals. And you were just talking about germlines. So what is these germline effects that you were talking about, and why are they of particular concern?
Okay, germline effects affect sexual reproduction. So any change that you make through germline effects are going to affect the life of not just the one that you're directly modifying at that moment, but any children that it has. And so that creates huge problems, or it creates huge benefits. So it could be that we eradicate something out of the entire family history, something like Huntington's disease, which will, if it expresses itself in any one of their offspring, it will be the reason that offspring dies. So if you can affect on a germline level something like that, you've done a great good for a family. But the problem is when we make changes that affect the germline, we don't fully understand how those effects are going to play out until we've seen multiple generations. So we've seen children born. And sometimes they take a long time to play out, even the life of those offspring. So theoretically speaking, you could have a germline effect that's negative for humanity, but that doesn't show up until well after people start having kids. And so they could have kids that have kids that have kids. And by the time we realize we've introduced something dangerous into the human family on a genetic level, it can be three generations down the stream. So germline are necessarily, and they know this, by the way, this is not an area where they don't express caution. They have in there, as they talk about being, they have concerns, real concerns about it. They say in the ISSCR guidelines, scientists currently lack an adequate understanding of the fidelity and precision of techniques for nuclear genome modification. So what they start to say is, we understand that we don't understand the potential long-term risk to individuals born following such a process. So they call for caution. They call for people to be careful about what they're doing because germline impacts can have long-term impact on the entire human race.
In your article, you write that some of the defenders of chimera research see human beings as animals, not human. And so if we change human beings into something different than human, and if some scientists, that's a goal that they have, why would some of these researchers want to change human beings or the classification of them?
Yeah, the evaluation of this type of medical and biological technology is entirely based on your worldview. I was just at North Carolina State, NC State, this last week, and I was talking to a chemical engineer there, and he and I were discussing certain aspects of this and how this plays out in the scientific community. If you have what we call a reductionist view of human beings, if you think we're just animals, then this research holds no ethical problem for you whatsoever, because what you're doing is you're taking what you would see as a shortcoming in the human genetic makeup, and you're taking something out of the animal kingdom and trying to plug it in there to change what was a problem for you. You have no loyalty or no sense that there's something special about humanity. Now, this is different, obviously, from the Christian understanding of what it means to be a human being. We believe that we are the image bearers of God, that God has set us apart, that he has special obligations and duties and requirements that he has placed into our lives, emanating from his character and from his commandments into it. So we have accountability to him for the things that we do to one another that is different from how we are accountable for the things that we do to other animals on the planet. Special obligations and duties that only exist within this relationship. And we have indication in scripture, which I mentioned in the article, to protect that difference, to keep those kinds as being something different. So for a Christian, we start with the idea that humanity was made differently and has a different responsibility and duty in the created order. For somebody who sees human beings as merely animals, they see no differentiation other than a few segments on the genetic code. And if they can cut out some of those segments or reintroduce animal genetic material into a human life to change the way, for example, I saw a man talking about the future where we can take amphibian DNA, mix it at an appropriate level with human DNA, and then at that point, we'll no longer have a problem with losing limbs, because if you cut a hand off, if we do this right, the hand will grow back. Well, for this person, this is a great idea because he sees the inability for a human being to grow a hand back in the same way that an amphibian could as a shortcoming of humanity that needs to be fixed or addressed. And this goes across the spectrum until you get into people like what we call post-humanist or transhumanist philosophers that are literally trying to force the evolution of humanity into something different through the uses of technology or biological sciences.
You know, a lot of times, I guess a reason against this kind of research would be that we shouldn't try to play God in these kinds of situations. You know, scientists shouldn't try to play God. Can we object to that, to this kind of research on that basis?
Yeah, that is the immediate response that you saw in the comment threads. NIH, and again, trying to be responsible, NIH had a moratorium on this sort of research. And what happened was other places, other countries in the world started to allow chimera research. And that means that you're going to get some degree of brain drain if there is a group of people that want to go to those places and do this research. That puts pressure on the United States to match what's happening elsewhere. But instead of just saying we're going to start funding this on a federal level, what they said was let's open up a comment period to find out how the American people feel about this. So I think obviously they're acting responsibly at this point. Well, the immediate backlash was we should not play God. And I understand that. And as I've already said before, the idea of God creating us as certain kinds and then us trying to change that, there is some validity to the idea and principle that we shouldn't be playing God. But the problem is the term playing God is so poorly defined from our side or from the people that represent our side more often than not that it can be unhelpful when you enter into this dialogue because we do play God to some degree all of the time. And so you have to ask, at what point do we stop playing God? I mean, when we correct vision, are we playing God? Well, I don't know anybody that actually thinks that. When we do animal testing to produce effective means of treating cancers, and many of us, including myself, have had loved ones who have died of cancer or who are fighting cancer right now. And so when we see medical science using aggressive forms of research on the genetic level to be able to help us fight these by using animals, well, I don't want to object to that. I want it to be ethically done and compassionately done, but I also want human beings to be able to survive cancer. My daughter's a type 1 diabetic. In order to produce the insulin that makes it possible for her to live past the next week, because without the insulin, she would die very quickly, we have tricked an E. coli bacteria to be able to produce massive amounts of insulin by replacing part of its genetic strain with the part of the protein from the human strain that produces insulin. And so we turn E. coli into little insulin-producing machines, and as a result of fundamentally changing the nature of that bacterial life, my daughter gets to live as opposed to having died at the age of 8 when she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. We change proteins in people to treat other things, not from burns to blood clotting to all sorts of things. So the question is, at what point do we draw the line and say this is playing God? And that's why I think saying playing God isn't helpful, because I don't think people have thought through exactly what they're saying enough to say there's a clear limit of what tinkering with life and other life on Earth, which we even patent. I mean, those E. coli were patented. They're patented organisms, and I'm fine with that. But at what point do we reach a place where now we're really playing God? So instead of objecting on the purpose of playing God, we need to object on grounds that can be understood by the people that we're trying to appeal to and not something that's too broadly stated so as to be unclear to them what exactly is our problem with this particular kind of research.
A little bit ago, you were talking about, you know, some scientists having a completely different worldview, and they would classify human beings as just another type of animal. I mean, on the flip side, do you think any Christians, you know, as Christians, do we really think about what it means to be human or consider exactly what we are? And if we don't, like, what are some of the important differences between human beings and animals, as we, you know, come across people who would argue, well, we're just another evolved type of animal and that we should be able to do this research to better humanity?
The lack of serious thought about what it means to be a human within the church is something that I encounter, and I know a lot of people who we talk about the value of human life encounter a lot. Obviously, I talk about things like abortion, physician-assisted suicide, talk about genetic research and these areas. And when I go and talk to churches, my people, in a sense, the Christian people, what I find is that we have not been very reflective on that question, what are we? I say in the article that there's two questions that we have to answer before we can determine the ethics of these kinds of researches. What are we and what are they? And we have to determine within a worldview that's consistent with biblical teaching and with what we understand God has taught us about the identity of human beings. And what you find is that Greg Kokel talks about the idea of most people not having a worldview that they have developed, they catch it. They've actually caught a worldview from somewhere else. And because of that, it can be mixed and muddled. I can have a conversation with someone where I hear consequentialist reasoning, utilitarian reasoning, virtue ethics reasoning, all of these different ways of coming up in one conversation from the same person, deontological reasoning, the kind of moral philosophy that says that there are orders or principles to which we that are higher than others to which we're obligated to pursue as rational beings. You hear all of these different things coming from the same person, and these don't sit well with each other. They don't work well with each other. But what's happened is they've looked for the way to argue for what it is they want right now, without having a clear understanding about what it means to be a human being. For us, as near as I can tell, as far as the biblical teaching goes, again, we are the image bearers of God. We have been set apart as a special creation. Now, there are different ways that the different Christians understand what that ultimately means, whether it's through the idea that we have a special nature, a human nature that is substantive to us, or whether we are set apart simply by God's divine commands. But either way, what we know is that human beings are different from the rest of the animal world as far as our obligations and duties and responsibilities to obey the commands of God and how we treat other people and how we treat His created order. And so we need to get back to a robust understanding of what it means to be human in the church, because the world around us demands that kind of an understanding. As these medical advances and scientific advances happen so rapidly and so quickly that our ethical reflections just can't keep up with what's happening. By the time we've heard about most of these things, it's a couple of years after people have already started experimenting on them.
Yeah, you're just talking about how our ethical reflections are not keeping pace with research. Why do you think maybe that the scientific research community doesn't take time for that ethical reflection in relation to all of this genetic manipulation? Is it because people are demanding cures now for specific diseases or something else?
Yeah, that's one thing, of course. Obviously, I think it's always helpful to give people, and as much as possible, the best motivations for the things that they do. And I think what you just said there is a huge, huge piece of this. There are people dying of terrible diseases. My daughter is a type 1 diabetic. I've mentioned that. I'm all for cures, but the Juvenile Diabetes Association the foundation that raises money for research, JDRF, actually endorses, and I mean boldly endorses, proudly endorses, embryo-destructive research. So my family can't be a part of funding the very research that people are doing to try to keep my daughter alive because they're so aggressively pursuing this. Why are they pursuing this? Because they have parents with children who are struggling, and they want to do everything that they can to help. There's a genuine need there. And so I do like to attribute those qualities. Also, I don't think it's fair to say that I try to be clear even at the end of the article to point out that the man in charge of this, Jonathan Kimmelman, who is the chair of the ethics committee for ISSCR, he and his past work has called for slower reflection, recognizing that this will slow down scientific development. There's a woman by the name of Jennifer Doudna who has probably come up with one of the most important bioengineering genome editing discoveries ever in what's called a CRISPR-Cas9 discovery in 2012. This is a game changer, which will allow us to edit genomes for almost any trait that we want with a precision that we never had before. And she called for immediately the scientific community to not do anything and for everybody to stop and take time to take in what's going on right now. The problem with that is, and she admits this in an interview that I saw, you can't stop it because Jennifer Doudna is acting responsibly and Jonathan Kimmelman is asking for responsibility. But the Chinese researchers that we hear about regularly are not acting responsibly. As soon as they hear something, they immediately go full tilt towards it. We know that we have doctors that travel to places like Mexico that have lower regulations and they go for it. There's too much money to be had. The United States NIH change of heart had nothing to do with the idea that something changed in our understanding of the nature of chimera research. It had everything to do with the fact that other large governments were starting to open up funds for chimera research. And there was going to be, what, like I said, a consistent, probably a considerable brain drain, people going to those other countries. It's interesting that 2 decades ago, Great Britain was dealing with a terrible brain drain, that the people that wanted to advance in science were leaving Great Britain and going elsewhere. Well, now Great Britain is one of the more aggressive countries in pursuing these types of genetic researches, and so people are flocking to Great Britain. This means money. It means talent. It means everything, and you can't stop it. And so you have doctors or scientists and professionals saying, we want to stop, we want to consider it, but sooner or later, they all admit at the end of the day, we're going to be doing this.
The end of your article states that this is a kind of a time in history that we really need a robust understanding of what it means to be human. And so why do you think that?
Yeah, one of the things over the last 10 years of studying the question of what it means to be human, what it means when we say that there are things that we ought not to do to other human beings, and who counts as members of our human family. One of the things I found most surprising is how we have such a short-term memory in the sense of how we understand the world that we live in, for the most part. There's obviously some very historically deeply passionate people who try to get a big picture. Think about the, I'll give you four medical advances and scientific advancements that have all happened relatively recently in human history. Medical science, which is a scientific approach to medicine as opposed to more Aristotelian ideas, that happens in the middle of the 19th century, late 19th century, earliest 20th century. Really the very first place where you have medical science take over a particular event, from what I understand from reading several books, and this is the great influenza of 1918. Antibiotics, mid-20th century. The first big thing is World War II, where penicillin is begun to use within the military. It spreads outside of there after that. DNA, Watson and Crick, they find a molecular structure in 1953. Integrated circuits for computers, which allow us to process things like a DNA structure faster and to understand what we're looking at, 1958. You have this incredible convergence of this ability to understand and to manipulate biology that the world has never seen before. There's never been a generation that had to answer the questions that this generation has to answer. It just has not existed in human history. And so now we have a responsibility, especially as Christians, even if we can't stop it, which I'm relatively skeptical about that idea. I think there's no will. Wesley Smith says that. There's no will to stop this within the scientific community or the culture around it. There's too much to be gained, money, cures, everywhere, and promises of prosperity all across the board for us to stop right now. But I think as Christians, as the church, as the body of Christ, we have to have a clear understanding about what it means to be a human, about what God calls us as human beings, so that we have an answer to the world around us, ethical, deep reflection on what's going on, so that we can inform our people, and also so that we have, there is a voice. We don't always have to win every argument to be an effective voice for change. Sometimes we just have to be there so that when things may start to go wrong, they remember that someone had spoken out, and they can then turn and say, you seem to have seen something was happening. You seem to have seen something was progressing this way. Something like Russell Moore would call a prophetic voice at that point. We have the responsibility to train the people in our church to understand what it means to be human, and we have an opportunity to be a prophetic voice, even if the world decides it refuses to slow down in a rush to be able to invent stuff and do things that no generation has ever seen done before.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Jay. So, Jay, cheese grits or hash browns?
Oh, that's tough. I'm a Georgia boy, so that depends on the morning, because really my answer is both. I mean, it'll make it sound terribly unhealthy, but give me both cheese grits and actually cheese hash browns. I want cheese on everything.
Okay, famous person living or dead you'd like to sit next to at a dinner party, and why?
Oh, wow. William Wilberforce? Just because the world was one way. You know, Aaron Metaxas talks about that in Amazing Grace, and so do a couple other writers. At the time that William Wilberforce and his group began their campaign, Thomas Clarkson, to change the face of slavery on the earth, the idea that slavery couldn't exist in London or England or throughout the British Empire was unthinkable. And by the time he died, it was gone. And just to sit, I mean, you read what he was like. He just sounds like an amazing guy to talk to, high energy, passionate, caring individual. And so he would be probably somebody that I'd like to talk to. I used to say Bonhoeffer, but the more I think about it, the more I think Bonhoeffer might be a little tough for dinner.
Okay, what's the first job you ever had?
I was a cash register working guy at Fuddruckers, which is a family hamburger place. And so I took orders, and I had to get a liquor license because I hadn't had him paying beer over. I had to get that job because when I was younger, I was wild and a little crazy, and my parents made me quit swimming, which I was on a traveling swimming team, a competitive club here in Georgia, and they said, you have to get a job tomorrow or you get no more money. And so I ran out and got a job, and Fuddruckers would hire me. And so I worked there for a long time, serving hamburgers and giving people their bottles of beer.
Okay, besides the Bible, what's one book you think that every Christian should own?
Wow. That's tough. There's, because, you know, I'm tempted to say something that is apologetics in nature, but ultimately for me, I'm much more changed by literature. I mean, literature has a very long impact on me. I wish people would have the discipline, you see it lacking a lot of times today, to read something like Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. I think there's so much grace in that book. So much for people who have been lost, given up, isolated. I have some experience of that when I was younger in my life. And so when I read that book, I see a redemption story of someone who looks by all purposes lost. So probably Crime and Punishment for me. I think Christians should read great literature. It's transformative in a way I don't think the other stuff is.
Yes, it very much is. And in fact, in the Christian Research Journal, we have started publishing articles on literary apologetics, and we have covered Dostoevsky, so you could check the website out for a free article on that. Well, Jay, it was great to have you on the Postmodern Realities podcast. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much, Melanie.
Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 1-888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure you go to equip.org, where you can download our free smartphone app on which you can listen to the Bible Answer Man broadcast live, listen to previous broadcasts, make a donation, and subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please share this episode on your social media accounts. Today, we have been having a conversation with Jay Watts, who has written a feature article called On Chimeras, What It Means to Be Human, for the Volume 40, Number 1 issue of the Christian Research Journal. And this article is in a very special issue of the journal, which is only available as a thank you gift for your donation to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. So to donate and receive Volume 40, Number 1, please go to equip.org. So until our next author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.